Spots of color were blooming in Durgan's cheeks. After hello, what then? I don't recall. Did he ask you about that morning? I don't recall. Didn't you tell him that Mary DeVore and her daughter were together, Mr. Noonan? That they were together picking flowers? Isn't that what you told this worried grandfather when he inquired about the incident which was the talk of the township that 4th of July? Oh, boy, Bissonnette said. He raised one hand over the table, then touched the palm with the fingers of the other, making a ref's tee. Time out. Durgan looked at him. The flush in his cheeks was more pronounced now, and his lips had pulled back enough to show the tips of small, neatly capped teeth. What do you want? He almost snarled, as if Bissonnette had just dropped by to tell him about the Mormon way, or perhaps the Rosicrucians. I want you to stop leading this guy, and I want that whole thing about picking flowers stricken from the record, Bissonnette said. Why? Durgan snapped. Because you're trying to get stuff on the record that this witness won't say? If you want a break here for a while so we can make a conference call to Judge Rancourt, get his opinion, I withdraw the question, Durgan said. He looked at me with a kind of helpless, surly rage. Mr. Noonan, do you want to help me do my job? I want to help Kyra DeVore if I can, I said. Very well. He nodded as if no distinction had been made. Then please tell me what you and Maxwell DeVore talked about. I can't recall. I caught his eyes and held them. Perhaps, I said, you can refresh my recollection. There was a moment of silence, like that which sometimes strikes a high-stakes poker game just after the last of the bets have been made and just before the players show their hands. Even the old fighter pilot was quiet, his eyes unblinking above the mask. Then Durgan pushed the cassette player aside with the heel of his hand. The set of his mouth said he felt about it just then as I often felt about the telephone, and went back to the morning of July 4th. He never asked about my dinner with Maddie and Kai on Tuesday night, and never returned to my telephone conversation with DeVore, the one where I had said all those awkward and easily disprovable things. I went on answering questions until 11:30, but the interview really ended when Durgan pushed the tape player away with the heel of his hand. I knew it, and I'm pretty sure he did, too. Mike! Mike, over here! Maddie was waving from one of the tables in the picnic area behind the town commons bandstand. She looked vibrant and happy. I waved back and made my way in that direction, weaving between little kids playing tag, skirting a couple of teenagers making out on the grass, and ducking a frisbee which a German shepherd leaped up and caught smartly. There was a tall, skinny redhead with her, but I barely got a chance to notice him. Maddie met me while I was still on the gravel path, put her arms around me, hugged me. It was no prudy little ass-poking-out hug either. And then kissed me on the mouth hard enough to push my lips against my teeth. There was a hearty smack when she disengaged. She pulled back and looked at me with undisguised delight. Was it the biggest kiss you've ever had? The biggest in at least 4 years, I said. Will you settle for that? And if she didn't step away from me in the next few seconds, she was going to have physical proof of how much I had enjoyed it. I guess I'll have to. She turned to the red-headed guy with a funny kind of defiance. Was that all right? Probably not, he said, but at least you're not currently in view of those old boys at the all-purpose garage. Mike, I'm John Starrow. Nice to meet you in person. I liked him at once, maybe because I'd come upon him dressed in his three-piece New York suit and primly setting out paper plates on a picnic table, while his curly red hair blew around his head like kelp. His skin was fair and freckled, the kind which would never tan, only burn and then peel in great eczema-like patches. When we shook, his hand seemed to be all knuckles. He had to be at least 30, but he looked Maddie's age, and I guessed it would be another 5 years before he was able to get a drink without showing his driver's license. "Sit down," he said. "We've got a 5-course lunch, courtesy of Castle Rock Variety. Grinders, which are for some strange reason called Italian sandwiches up here, mozzarella sticks, garlic fries, Twinkies. That's only four, I said. I forgot the soft drink course, he said, and pulled three long-neck bottles of S&OK birch beer out of a brown bag. Let's eat. Maddie runs the library from 2 to 8 on Fridays and Saturdays, and this would be a bad time for her to be missing work. How did the reader's circle go last night, I asked. Lindy Briggs didn't eat you alive, I see. She laughed, clasped her hands, and shook them over her head. I was a hit, an absolute smashola. I didn't dare tell them I got all my best insights from you. Thank God for small favors, Starro said. He was freeing his own sandwich from its string and butcher paper wrapping, doing it carefully and a little dubiously, using just the tips of his fingers. So I said I looked in a couple of books and found some leads there. It was sort of wonderful. I felt like a college kid. Good. Bissonette? John Starro asked. Where's he? I never met a guy named Romeo before. Said he had to go right back to Lewiston. Sorry. Actually, it's best we stay small, at least to begin with. He bit into his sandwich. They come tucked into long sub-rolls and looked at me, surprised. This isn't bad. Eat more than three and you're hooked for life, Maddie said, and chomped heartily into her own. Tell us about the depot, John said, and while they ate, I talked. When I finished, I picked up my own sandwich and played a little ketchup. I'd forgotten how good an Italian can be, sweet, sour, and oily all at the same time. Of course, nothing that tastes that good can be healthy, that's a given. I suppose one could formulate a similar postulate about full-body hugs from young girls in legal trouble. Very interesting, John said. Very interesting indeed. He took a mozzarella stick from its grease-stained bag, broke it open, and looked with a kind of fascinated horror at the clotted white gunk inside. "People up here eat this?" he asked. "People in New York eat fish bladders," I said. "Raw." "I suppose so." He dipped a piece into the plastic container of spaghetti sauce. In this context, it is called cheese dip in Western Maine. Then ate it. "Well?" I asked. Not bad. They ought to be a lot hotter, though. Yes, he was right about that. Eating cold mozzarella sticks is a little like eating cold snot, an observation I thought I would keep to myself on this beautiful midsummer Friday. If Durgan had the tape, why wouldn't he play it? Maddie asked. I don't understand. John stretched his arms out, cracked his knuckles, and looked at her benignly. We'll probably never know for sure, he said. He thought DeVore was going to drop the suit. It was in every line of his body language and every inflection of his voice. That was hopeful, but it would be good if Maddie didn't allow herself to become too hopeful. John Starro wasn't as young as he looked, and probably not as guileless either, or so I fervently hoped, but he was young, and neither he nor Maddie knew the story of Scooter Larrabee's sled, or had seen Bill Dean's face when he told it. Want to hear some possibilities? Sure, I said. John put down his sandwich, wiped his fingers, and then began to tick off points. First, he made the call. Taped conversations have a highly dubious value under those circumstances. Second, he didn't exactly come off as Captain Kangaroo, did he? No. Third, your fabrication impugns you, Mike, but not really very much, and it doesn't impugn Maddie at all. And by the way, that thing about Maddie pushing bubbles in Kyra's face, I love that. If that's the best they can do, they better give it up right now. Last, and this is where the truth probably lies, I think DeVore's got Nixon's disease. Nixon's disease? Maddie asked. The tape Durgan had isn't the only tape. Can't be. And your father-in-law is afraid that if he introduces one tape made by whatever system he's got in Warrington's, we might subpoena all of them. And I'd damn well try. She looked bewildered. What could be on them? And if it's bad, why not just destroy them? Maybe he can't, I said. Maybe he needs them for other reasons. It doesn't really matter, John said. Durgan was bluffing, and that's what matters. He hit the heel of his hand lightly against the picnic table. I think he's going to drop it. I really do. "It's too early to start thinking like that," I said at once. But I could tell by Maddie's face, shining more brightly than ever, that the damage was done. "Fill him in on what else you've been doing," Maddie told John. "Then I've got to get to the library." "Where do you send Kyra on your work days?" I asked. "Mrs. Cullum's. She lives 2 miles up the Wasp Hill Road. Also in July, there's VBS from 10 until 3. That's Vacation Bible School. Kai loves it, especially the singing and the flannel board stories about Noah and Moses. The bus drops her off at Arlene's, and I pick her up around 9:15. She smiled a little wistfully. By then, she's usually fast asleep on the couch. John held forth for the next 10 minutes or so. He hadn't been on the case long, but it already started a lot of balls rolling. A fellow in California was gathering facts about Roger DeVore and Morris Ridding. Gathering facts sounded so much better than snooping. John was particularly interested in learning about the quality of Roger DeVore's relations with his father, and if Roger was on record concerning his little niece from Maine. John had also mapped out a campaign to learn as much as possible about Max DeVore's movements and activities since coming back to TR-90. To that end, he had the name of a private investigator, one recommended by Romeo Bissonette, my rental lawyer. As he spoke, paging rapidly through a little notebook he drew from the inside pocket of his suit coat, I remembered what he'd said about Lady Justice during our telephone conversation. "Slap some handcuffs on that broad's wrist to go along with the blindfold, rape her, and roll her in the mud." That was maybe a bit too strong for what we were doing, but I thought at the very least we were shoving her around a little. I imagined poor Roger DeVore up on the stand, having flown 3,000 miles in order to be questioned about his sexual preferences. I had to keep reminding myself that his father had put him in that position, not Maddie or me or John Starrow. "Have you gotten any closer to a meeting with DeVore and his chief legal advisor?" I asked. "Don't know for sure. The line is in the water, the offer on the table, the puck's on the ice, pick your favorite metaphor, mix 'em and match 'em if you desire." "Got your irons in the fire," Maddie said solemnly. "Your checker's on the board," I added. We looked at each other and laughed. John regarded us sadly, then sighed, picked up his sandwich, and began to eat again. "You really have to meet him with his lawyer more or less dancing attendance?" I asked. "Would you like to win this thing, then discover DeVore can do it all again based on unethical behavior by Mary DeVore's legal resource?" John returned. "Don't even joke about it," Maddie cried. "I wasn't joking," John said. "It has to be with his lawyer, yes. I don't think it's going to happen, not on this trip. I haven't even got a look at the old caca, and I have to tell you my curiosity is killing me." "If that's all it takes to make you happy, show up behind the backstop at the softball field next Tuesday evening," Maddie said. "He'll be there in his fancy wheelchair, laughing and clapping and sucking his damned old oxygen every 15 minutes or so." "Not a bad idea," John said. "I have to go back to New York for the weekend. I'm leaving Après Osgood. But maybe I'll show up on Tuesday. I might even bring my glove." He began clearing up our litter, and once again I thought he looked both prissy and endearing at the same time, like Stan Laurel wearing an apron. Maddie eased him aside and took over. "No one ate any Twinkies," she said a little sadly. "Take them home to your daughter," John said. "No way. I don't let her eat stuff like this. What kind of mother do you think I am?" She saw our expressions, replayed what she'd just said, then burst out laughing. We joined her. Maddie's old scout was parked in one of the slant spaces behind the war memorial, which in Castle Rock is a World War I soldier with a generous helping of bird shit on his pie-dish helmet. A brand-new Taurus with a Hertz decal above the inspection sticker was parked next to it. John tossed his briefcase, reassuringly thin and not very ostentatious, into the back seat. "If I can make it back on Tuesday, I'll call you," he told Maddie. "If I'm able to get an appointment with your father-in-law through this man Osgood, I will also call you." "I'll buy the Italian sandwiches," Maddie said. He smiled, then grasped her arm in one hand and mine in the other. He looked like a newly ordained minister getting ready to marry his first couple. "You two talk on the telephone if you need to," he said, always remembering that one or both lines may be tapped. "Meet in the market if you happen to. Mike, you might feel a need to drop by the local library and check out a book." "Not until you renew your card, though," Maddie said, giving me a demure glance. "But no more visits to Maddie's trailer. Is that understood?" I said yes. She said yes. John Storrow looked unconvinced. It made me wonder if he was seeing something in our faces or bodies that shouldn't be there. "They are committed to a line of attack which probably isn't going to work," he said. "We can't risk giving them the chance to change course. That means innuendos about the two of you. It also means innuendos about Mike and Kyra." Maddie's shocked expression made her look 12 again. "Mike and Kyra? What are you talking about?" "Allegations of child molestation thrown up by people so desperate they'll try anything." "That's ridiculous," she said. "And if my father-in-law wanted to sling that kind of mud..." John nodded. "Yes, we'd be obliged to sling it right back. Newspaper coverage from coast to coast would follow, maybe even court TV, God bless and save us. We want none of that if we can avoid it. It's not good for the grown-ups, and it's not good for the child. Now or later." He bent and kissed Maddie's cheek. "I'm sorry about all this," he said, and he did sound genuinely sorry. "Custody's just this way. I think you warned me. It's just that the idea someone might make a thing like that up just because there was no other way for them to win." "Let me warn you again," he said. His face came as close to grim as its young and good-natured features would probably allow. "What we have is a very rich man with a very shaky case. The combination could be like working with old dynamite." I turned to Maddie. "Are you still worried about Kai? Still feel she's in danger?" I saw her think about hedging her response, out of plain old Yankee reserve, quite likely, and then deciding not to. Deciding, perhaps, that hedging was a luxury she couldn't afford. "Yes, but it's just a feeling, you know." John was frowning. I suppose the idea that DeVore might resort to extra-legal means of obtaining what he wanted had occurred to him as well. "Keep your eye on her as much as you can," he said. "I respect intuition. Is yours based on anything concrete?" "No," Maddie answered, and her quick glance in my direction asked me to keep my mouth shut. "Not really." She opened the scout's door and tossed in the little brown bag with the Twinkies in it. She had decided to keep them after all. Then she turned to John and me with an expression that was close to anger. "I'm not sure how to follow that advice anyway. I work 5 days a week, and in August, when we do the microfiche update, it'll be 6. Right now, Kai gets her lunch at Vacation Bible School and her dinner from Arlene Cullen. I see her in the mornings. The rest of the time..." I knew what she was going to say before she said it. The expression was an old one. "She's on the TR. "I could help you find an au pair," I said, thinking it would be a hell of a lot cheaper than John Storrow. "No," they said in such perfect unison that they glanced at each other and laughed. But even while she was laughing, Maddie looked tense and unhappy. "We're not going to leave a paper trail for Durgan or DeVore's custody team to exploit," John said. "Who pays me is one thing. Who pays Maddie's child care help is another." "Besides, I've taken enough from you," Maddie said, "more than I can sleep easy on. I'm not going to get in any deeper just because I've been having megrims." She climbed into the scout and closed the door. I rested my hands on her open window. Now we were on the same level, and the eye contact was so strong it was disconcerting. "Maddie, I don't have anything else to spend it on, really. When it comes to John's fee, I accept that, because John's fee is about Kai." She put her hand over mine and squeezed briefly. "This other is about me. All right?" "Yeah, but you need to tell your babysitter and the people who run this Bible thing that you've got a custody case on your hands, a potentially bitter one, and Kyra's not to go anywhere with anyone, even someone they know, without your say-so." She smiled. "It's already been done, on John's advice. Stay in touch, Mike." She lifted my hand, gave it a hearty smack, and drove away. "What do you think?" I asked John as we watched the scout blow oil on its way to the new Prouty Bridge, which spans Castle Stream and spills outbound traffic onto Highway 68. "I think she's lucky to have a well-heeled benefactor and a smart lawyer," John said. He paused, then added, "But I'll tell you something. She somehow doesn't feel lucky to me at all. There's a feeling I get. I don't know. That there's a cloud around her you can't quite see. Maybe. Maybe that's it." He raked his hands through the restless mass of his red hair. "I just know it's something sad." I knew exactly what he meant. Except for me, there was more. I wanted to be in bed with her, sad or not, right or not. I wanted to feel her hands on me, tugging and pressing, patting and stroking. I wanted to be able to smell her skin and taste her hair. I wanted to have her lips against my ear, her breath tickling the fine hairs within its cup, as she told me to do what I wanted, whatever I wanted. I got back to Sarah Laugh's shortly before 2 o'clock and let myself in, thinking about nothing but my study and the IBM with the courier ball. I was writing again. Writing. I could still hardly believe it. I'd work, not that it felt much like work after a 4-year layoff, until maybe 6 o'clock, swim, then go down to the village cafe for one of Buddy's cholesterol-rich specialties. The moment I stepped through the door, Bunter's bell began to ring stridently. I stopped in the foyer, my hand frozen on the knob. The house was hot and bright, not a shadow anywhere, but the goose flesh forming on my arms felt like midnight. "Who's here?" I called. The bell stopped ringing. There was a moment of silence, and then a woman shrieked. It came from everywhere, pouring out of the sunny, moat-laden air like sweat out of hot skin. It was a scream of outrage, anger, grief, but mostly, I think, of horror. And I screamed in response. I couldn't help it. I had been frightened standing in the dark cellar stairwell, listening to the unseen fist thump on the insulation, but this was far worse. It never stopped, that scream. It faded as the child's sobs had faded. Faded as if the person screaming was being carried rapidly down a long corridor and away from me. At last it was gone. I leaned against the bookcase, my palm pressed against my T-shirt, my heart galloping beneath it. I was gasping for breath, and my muscles had that queer exploded feel they get after you've had a bad scare. A minute passed. My heartbeat gradually slowed, and my breathing slowed with it. I straightened up, took a tottery step, and when my legs held me, took 2 more. I stood in the kitchen doorway, looking across to the living room. Above the fireplace, Bunter the Moose looked glassily back at me. The bell around his neck hung still and chimeless. A hot sun point glowed on its side. The only sound was that stupid Felix the Cat clock in the kitchen. The thought nagging at me, even then, was that the screaming woman had been Joe, that Sarah Laughs was being haunted by my wife, and that she was in pain. Dead or not, she was in pain. "Joe?" I asked quietly. "Joe, are you..." The sobbing began again, the sound of a terrified child. At the same moment, my mouth and nose once more filled with the iron taste of the lake. I put one hand to my throat, gagging and frightened, then leaned over the sink and spat. It was as it had been before. Instead of voiding a huge gush of water, nothing came out but a little spit. The waterlogged feeling was gone as if it had never been there. I stayed where I was, grasping the counter and bent over the sink, probably looking like a drunk who has finished the party by upchucking most of the night's bottled cheer. I felt like that, too, stunned and bleary, too overloaded to really understand what was going on. At last I straightened up again, took the towel folded over the dishwasher's handle, and wiped my face with it. There was tea in the fridge, and I wanted a tall, ice-choked glass of it in the worst way. I reached for the door handle and froze. The fruit and vegetable magnets were drawn into a circle again. In the center was this: "Help, I'm drowned." "That's it," I thought. "I'm getting out of here, right now, today." Yet an hour later, I was up in my stifling study with a glass of tea on the desk beside me, the cubes in it long since melted, dressed only in my bathing suit and lost in the world I was making, the one where a private detective named Andy Drake was trying to prove that John Shackelford was not the serial killer nicknamed Baseball Cap. This is how we go on, one day at a time, one meal at a time, one pain at a time, one breath at a time. Dentists go on one root canal at a time. Boat builders go on one hull at a time. If you write books, you go on one page at a time. We turn from all we know and all we fear. We study catalogs, watch football games, choose Sprint over AT&T. We count the birds in the sky and will not turn from the window when we hear the footsteps behind us as something comes up the hall. We say, "Yes, I agree that clouds often look like other things, fish and unicorns and men on horseback, but they are really only clouds." Even when the lightning flashes inside them, we say they are only clouds and turn our attention to the next meal, the next pain, the next breath, the next page. This is how we go on. The book was big, okay? The book was major. I was afraid to change rooms, let alone pack up the typewriter in my slim, just-begun manuscript and take it back to Derry. That would be as dangerous as taking an infant out into a windstorm. So I stayed, always reserving the right to move out if things got too weird, the way smokers reserve the right to quit if their coughs get too heavy. And a week passed. Things happened during that week, but until I met Max DeVore on the street the following Friday, the 17th of July it would have been, the most important thing was that I continued to work on a novel which would, if finished, be called My Childhood Friend. Perhaps we always think what was lost was the best, or would have been the best. I don't know for sure. What I do know is that my real life that week had mostly to do with Andy Drake, John Shackelford, and a shadowy figure standing in the deep background, Raymond Garrity, John Shackelford's childhood friend, a man who sometimes wore a baseball cap. During that week, the manifestations in the house continued, but at a lower level. There was nothing like that blood-curdling scream. Sometimes Bunter's bell rang. Sometimes the fruit and vegetable magnets would reform themselves into a circle. Never with words in the middle, though. Not that week. One morning I got up and the sugar canister was overturned, making me think of Maddie's story about the flower. Nothing was written in the spill, but there was a squiggle, as though something had tried to write and failed. If so, I sympathized. I knew what that was like. My depot before the redoubtable Elmer Durgan was on Friday the 14th. On the following Tuesday, I took the street down to Warrington's softball field, hoping for my own peek at Max DeVore. It was going on 6 o'clock when I got within hearing range of the shouts, cheers, and batted balls. A path marked with rustic signs, curlicued W's burned into oak arrows, led past the abandoned boathouse, a couple of sheds, and a gazebo half buried in blackberry creepers. I eventually came out in deep center field. A litter of potato chip bags, candy wrappers, and beer cans suggested that others sometimes watched the games from this vantage point. I couldn't help thinking about Joe and her mysterious friend, the guy in the old brown sport coat, the burly guy who had slipped an arm around her waist and led her away from the game, laughing, back toward the street. Twice over the weekend I'd come close to calling Bonnie a Mudson, seeing if maybe I could chase that guy down, put a name on him, and both times I had backed off. Sleeping dogs, I told myself each time. Sleeping dogs, Michael. I had the area beyond deep center to myself that evening, and it felt like the right distance from home plate, considering the man who usually parked his wheelchair behind the backstop had called me a liar, and I had invited him to store my telephone number where the sunshine grows dim. I needn't have worried in any case. DeVore wasn't in attendance, nor was the lovely Roguette. I did spot Maddie behind the casually maintained chicken wire barrier on the first baseline. John Starrow was beside her, wearing jeans and a polo shirt, his red hair mostly corralled by a Mets cap. They stood watching the game and chatting like old friends for two innings before they saw me. More than enough time for me to feel envious of John's position, and a little jealous as well. Finally, someone lofted a long fly to center, where the edge of the woods served as the only fence. The center fielder backed up, but it was going to be far over his head. It was hit to my depth, off to my right. I moved in that direction without thinking, high-footing through the shrubs that formed a zone between the mown outfield and the trees, hoping I wasn't running through poison ivy. I caught the softball in my outstretched left hand and laughed when some of the spectators cheered. The center fielder applauded me by tapping his bare right hand into the pocket of his glove. The batter, meanwhile, circled the bases serenely, knowing he had hit a ground rule home run. I tossed the ball to the fielder, and as I returned to my original post among the candy wrappers and beer cans, I looked back in and saw Maddie and John looking at me. If anything confirms the idea that we're just one more species of animal, one with a slightly bigger brain and a much bigger idea of our own importance in the scheme of things, it's how much we can convey by gesture when we absolutely have to. Maddie clasped her hands to her chest, tilted her head to the left, raised her eyebrows. My hero. I held my hands to my shoulders and flipped the palms skyward. Shucks, ma'am, 'twarn't nothing. John lowered his head and put his fingers to his brow as if something there hurt. You lucky son of a bitch. With those comments out of the way, I pointed at the backstop and shrugged a question. Both Maddie and John shrugged back. An inning later, a little boy who looked like one giant exploding freckle ran out to where I was, his oversized Michael Jordan jersey churning around his shins like a dress. Guy down there give me 50 cents to say you should call him later on at his hotel over in the Rock, he said, pointing at John. He say you'd give me another 50 cents if there was an answer. Tell him I'll call him around 9:30, I said. I don't have any change, though. Can you take a buck? Hey, yeah, swank. He snatched it, turned away, then turned back. He grinned, revealing a set of teeth caught between Act One and Act Two. With the softball players in the background, he looked like a Norman Rockwell archetype. Guy also say to tell you that was a bullshit catch. Tell him people used to say the same thing about Willie Mays all the time. Willie who? Ah, you. Ah, Maurice. Just tell him, son. He'll know. I stayed another inning, but by then the game was getting drunk, DeVore still hadn't shown, and I went back home the way I had come. I met one fisherman standing out on a rock and two young people strolling along the street toward Warrington's, their hands linked. They said hi, and I hied them back. I felt lonely and content at the same time. I believe that is a rare kind of happiness. Some people check their phone answering machines when they get home. That summer, I always checked the front of the fridge. Eeny, meeny, chilly, beanie, as Bullwinkle Moose used to say, the spirits are about to speak. That night they hadn't, although the fruit and vegetable magnets had reformed into a sinuous shape like a snake or perhaps the letter S taking a nap. A little later, I called John and asked him where DeVore had been, and he repeated in words what he had already told me, and much more economically by gesture. It's the first game he's missed since he came back, he said. Maddie tried asking a few people if he was okay, and the consensus seemed to be that he was, at least as far as anyone knew. What do you mean she tried asking a few people? I mean that several wouldn't even talk to her. Cut her dead, my parents' generation would have said. Watch it, buddy, I thought, but didn't say. That's only half a step from my generation. One of her old girlfriends spoke to her finally, but there's a general attitude about Maddie DeVore. That man Osgood may be a shitty realtor, but as DeVore's Mr. Money Guy, he's doing a wonderful job of separating Maddie from the other folks in the town. Is it a town, Mike? I don't quite get that part. It's just the TR, I said absently. There's no real way to explain it. Do you really believe DeVore's bribing everyone? That doesn't say much for the good old Wordsworthian idea of pastoral innocence and goodness, does it? He's spreading money and using Osgood, maybe Footman too, to spread stories. And the folks around here seem at least as honest politicians. The ones who stay bought? Yeah. Oh, and I saw one of DeVore's potential star witnesses in the case of the runaway child, Royce Merrill. He was over by the equipment shed with some of his cronies. Did you happen to notice him? I said I had not. Guy must be 130, John said. He's got a cane with a gold head the size of an elephant's asshole. That's a Boston Post cane. The oldest person in the area gets to keep it. And I have no doubt he came by it honestly. If DeVore's lawyers put him on the stand, I'll debone him. There was something chilling in John's gleeful confidence. I'm sure, I said. How did Maddie take getting cut dead by her old friend? I was thinking of her saying that she hated Tuesday nights, hated to think of the softball games going on as they always had at the field where she had met her late husband. She did okay, John said. I think she's given most of them up as a lost cause anyway. I had my doubts about that. I seemed to remember that at 20, lost causes are sort of a specialty, but I didn't say anything. She's hanging in. She's been lonely and scared. I think that in her own mind she might already have begun the process of giving Kyra up. But she's got her confidence back now, mostly thanks to meeting you. Talk about your fantastically lucky breaks. Well, maybe. I flashed on Joe's brother Frank once saying to me that he didn't think there was any such thing as luck, only fate and inspired choices. And then I remembered that image of the TR crisscrossed with invisible cables, connections that were unseen but as strong as steel. John, I forgot to ask the most important question of all the other day after I gave my depot. This custody case we're all so concerned about, has it even been scheduled? Good question. I've checked three ways to Sunday, and Bissonette has too. Unless DeVore and his people have pulled something really slippery, like filing in another court district, I don't think it has been. Could they do that? File in another district? Maybe, but probably not without us finding out. So what does it mean? That DeVore's on the verge of giving up, John said promptly. As of now, I see no other way of explaining it. I'm going back to New York first thing tomorrow, but I'll stay in touch. If anything comes up here, you do the same. I said I would and went to bed. No female visitors came to share my dreams. That was sort of a relief.